but no one wanted it. And no one could, but it was a pity. He would have charged 100 marks an hour, the same as certain professors of music. And at the same time, he found it amusing to refute himself. All this was nonsense, the shadows of nonsense, presumptuous dreams. I'm simply a poor young Russian selling the surplus from a gentleman's upbringing while scribbling verses in my spare time. That's the total of my little immortality. But even this shade of multifaceted thought, this play of the mind with its own self, had no prospective pupils. The bus rolled on, and presently he arrived at his destination, the place of a lone and lonesome young woman, very attractive in spite of her freckles, always wearing a black dress opened at the neck and with lips like sealing wax on a letter in which there was nothing. She continually looked at Fyodor with pensive curiosity, not only taking no interest in the remarkable novel by Stevenson, which he had been reading with her for the past 3 months, and before that they had read Kipling at the same rate, but also not understanding a single sentence, and noting down words as you would note down the address of someone you knew you would never visit. Even now, or more exactly, precisely now, and with greater agitation than before, Fyodor, although in love with another who was incomparable in fascination and intelligence, wondered what would happen if he placed his palm on this slightly trembling little hand with the sharp fingernails lying so invitingly close. And because he knew what would happen, then his heart suddenly began to thump, and his lips immediately went dry. At this point, however, he was involuntarily sobered by a certain intonation of hers, her little laugh, the smell of that certain scent which somehow was always used by the very women who liked him, although to him this dullish, sweetish brown smell was unbearable. She was a worthless, cunning woman with a sluggish soul. But even now, when the lesson was over and he had gone out into the street, he was seized by a vague feeling of annoyance. He could imagine much better than he had just been able to, in her presence, how gaily and yieldingly her compact little body would probably have responded to everything. And with painful vividness, he saw in an imaginary mirror his hand on her back and her smooth auburn head thrown back. And then the mirror significantly emptied, and he experienced that most trivial of all feelings on earth, the stab of a missed opportunity. No, that was not so. He had missed nothing. The sole joy of these unrealizable embraces was their ease of evocation. During the past 10 years of lonely and restrained youth, living on a cliff where there was always a bit of snow, and from where it was a long way down to the little brewery town at the foot of the mountain, he had become accustomed to the thought that between the deceit of casual love and the sweetness of its temptation, there was a void, a gap in life, an absence of any real action on his part, so that on occasion when he looked at a passing girl, he imagined simultaneously both a stupendous possibility of happiness and repugnance for its inevitable imperfection, charging this one instant with a romantic image, but diminishing its triptych by the middle section. He knew, therefore, that their reading of Stevenson would never be interrupted by a Dantean pause, knew that if such a break should take place, he would not experience a thing except a devastating chill because the demands of the imagination were unfulfillable, and because the vacuousness of a gaze forgiven for the sake of beautiful, moist eyes inevitably corresponded to a defect as yet concealed, the vacuous expression of breasts, which it was impossible to forgive. But sometimes he envied the simple love life of other men, and the way they probably had of whistling while taking off their shoes. Crossing Wittenberg Square, where, as in a color film, roses were quivering in the breeze around an antique flight of stairs which led down to an underground station, he walked toward the Russian bookshop. Between lessons there was a chink of spare time. As always happened when he came to this street, beginning under the auspices of a huge department store that sold all forms of local bad taste, and ending after several crossroads in burgerish calm, with poplar shadows on the asphalt, all chalked over by hopscotchers, he met an elderly, morbidly embittered St. Petersburg writer who wore an overcoat in summer to hide the shabbiness of his suit, a dreadfully skinny man with bulging dark brown eyes, wrinkles of fastidious distaste around his apish mouth, and one long curved hair growing out of a big black pore on his broad nose, a detail which attracted Fyodor Konstantinovich's attention much more than the conversation of this clever schemer, who embarked immediately he met anyone upon something in the nature of a fable, a long, far-fetched anecdote of yore, which turned out to be merely a prelude to some amusing gossip about a mutual acquaintance. Fyodor had barely got rid of him when he caught sight of two more writers, a good-naturedly gloomy Muscovite whose carriage and aspect were somewhat reminiscent of the Napoleon of the Island period, and a satirical poet from the Berlin Russian émigré paper, a frail little man with a kindly wit and a quiet, hoarse voice. These two, like their predecessor, invariably turned up in this region, which they used for leisurely walks, rich in encounters, so that it seemed as if on this German street there had encroached the vagabond phantom of a Russian boulevard, or as if, on the contrary, a street in Russia, with several natives taking the air, swarmed with the pale ghosts of innumerable foreigners, flickering among those natives like a familiar and barely noticeable hallucination. They chatted about the writer just encountered, and Fyodor sailed on. After a few steps, he noticed Koncheyev reading on the stroll the feuilleton at the bottom of the Paris Russian émigré paper, with a marvelous angelic smile on his round face. The engineer Kern came out of a Russian food shop, cautiously thrusting a small parcel into the briefcase pressed against his chest, and on a cross street, like the confluence of people in a dream or in the last chapter of Turgenev's Smoke, he caught a glimpse of Mariana Nikolaevna Shchogolev with some other lady, mustachioed and very stout, who perhaps was Madame Abramov. Immediately after that, Alexander Yakovlevich Chernyshevsky cut across the street. No, a mistake. A stranger, not even very like him. Fyodor Konstantinovich reached the bookshop. In the window he could see among the zigzags, cogs, and numerals of Soviet cover designs. This was the time when the fashion there was to have titles like Third Love, The Sixth Sense, and Point 17, several new émigré publications. A corpulent new romance by General Kachurin, The Red Princess, Koncheyev's Communication, the pure white paperbacks of two venerable novelists, an anthology of recitable poetry published in Riga, the minute palm-sized volume of a young poetess, a handbook, What a Driver Should Know, and the last work of Dr. Utin, The Foundations of a Happy Marriage. There were also several old St. Petersburg engravings, in one of which a mirror-like transposition had put the rostral column on the wrong side of the neighboring buildings. The owner of the shop was not there. He had gone to the dentist's, and his place was being taken by a rather accidental young lady reading a Russian translation of Kellerman's The Tunnel in a fairly uncomfortable pose in the corner. Fyodor Konstantinovich approached the table where the émigré periodicals were displayed. He unfolded the literary number of the Paris Russian News, and with a chill of sudden excitement he saw that the feuilleton by Christopher Mortus was devoted to Communication. What if he demolishes it? Fyodor managed to think with a mad hope. Already, however, hearing in his ears not the melody of detraction, but the sweeping roar of deafening praise, he greedily began to read. I do not remember who said, perhaps Razanov said it somewhere, began Mortis stealthily, and citing first this unauthentic quotation, and then some thought expressed by somebody in a Paris café after someone's lecture, he began to narrow these artificial circles around Koncheyev's Communication. But even so, to the very end, he never touched the center, but only directed now and then a mesmeric gesture toward it from the circumference, and again revolved. The result was something in the nature of those black spirals on cardboard circles which are everlastingly spinning in the windows of Berlin ice cream parlors in a crazy effort to turn into bull's eyes. It was a venomously disdainful dressing down, without a single remark to the point, without a single example. And not so much the critic's words as his whole manner made a pitiful and dubious phantom out of a book which Mortus could not fail to have read with delight, and from which he avoided quoting in order not to damage himself with the disparity between what he wrote and what he was writing about. The whole review seemed to be a seance for the summoning of a spirit which is announced in advance to be, if not a fraud, at least a delusion of the senses. "These poems," ended Mortus, "induce in the reader an indefinite but insuperable repulsion. People friendly to Koncheev's talent will probably think them enchanting. We shall not quarrel, perhaps this is really so. But in our difficult times, with their new responsibilities, when the very air is imbued with a subtle moral angoisse, an awareness of which is the infallible mark of genuineness in a contemporary poet, abstract and melodious little pieces about dreamy visions are incapable of seducing anyone. And in truth, it is with a kind of joyous relief that one passes from them to any kind of human document, to what one can read between the words in certain Soviet writers, granted even without talent, to an artless and sorrowful confession, to a private letter dictated by emotion and despair." At first, Fyodor Konstantinovich felt an acute, almost physical pleasure from this article, but it immediately dispersed and was replaced by a queer sensation, as if he had been taking part in a sly, evil business. He recalled Koncheyev's smile of a moment ago, over these very lines, of course, and it occurred to him that a similar smile might apply to him, Godunov Cherdintsev, whom envy had leagued with the critic. Here he recalled that Koncheyev himself, in his critical reviews, had more than once, from the heights, and in fact just as unscrupulously, stung Mortus, who was, by the way, in private life, a woman of middle age, the mother of a family, who in her youth had published excellent poems in the St. Petersburg review Apollo, and who now lived modestly 2 steps from the grave of Marie Bashkirtsev, suffering from an incurable eye illness, which endowed Mortus's every line with a kind of tragic value. And when Fyodor realized the infinitely flattering hostility of this article, he felt disappointed that no one wrote about him like that. He also looked through a little illustrated weekly published by Russian émigrés in Warsaw, and found a review on the same subject, but of a completely different cut. It was a critique bouffe. The local Valentin Ilyinov, who from issue to issue used to pour out his formless, reckless, and not altogether grammatical literary impressions, was famous not only for not being able to make sense of the book he reviewed, but also for not having apparently read it to the end. Jauntily using the author as a springboard, carried away by his own paraphrase, extracting isolated phrases in support of his incorrect conclusions, misunderstanding the initial pages and thereafter energetically pursuing a false trail, he would make his way to the penultimate chapter in the blissful state of a passenger who still does not know, and in his case never finds out, that he has boarded the wrong train. It invariably happened that having leafed blindly through a long novel or a short story, size played no part in it, he would provide the book with his own ending, usually exactly opposite to the author's intention. In other words, if, say, Gogol had been a contemporary and Ilyinov were writing about him, Ilyinov would remain firmly of the innocent conviction that Khlestakov was indeed the Inspector General. But when, as now, he wrote about poetry, he artlessly employed the device of so-called interquotational footbridges. His discussion of Koncheyev's book boiled down to his answering for the author a kind of implied album questionnaire. Your favorite flower? Favorite hero? Which virtue do you prize most? The poet, Ilyinov wrote of Koncheyev, likes, there followed a string of quotations, forcibly distorted by their combination and the demands of the accusative case. He dreads more bleeding stumps of verse. He finds solace in même jeu. But on the other hand, 3/4 of a line turned by means of quotes into a flat statement, At times it seems to him that, and here Lenyov inadvertently extricated something more or less whole, days of ripening vines, in the avenues blue-shaded statues, the fair heavens that lean on the motherland's shoulders of snow. And it was as if the voice of a violin had suddenly drowned the hum of a patriarchal cretin. On another table, a little farther, Soviet editions were laid out, and one could bend over the morass of Moscow magazines, over a hell of boredom, and even try to make out the agonizing constriction of capitalized abbreviations carried like doomed cattle all over Russia and horribly recalling the lettering on freight cars, the banging of their buffers, the clanking, the hunchbacked greaser with a lantern, the piercing melancholy of godforsaken stations, the shudder of Russian rails, infinitely long-distance trains. Between the Star and the Red Lamp, trembling in railway smoke, lay an edition of the Soviet chess magazine 8x8. As Fyodor leafed through it, rejoicing over the human language of the problem diagrams, he noticed a small article with the picture of a thin-bearded old man glowering over his spectacles. The article was headed Chernyshevsky and Chess. He thought that this might amuse Alexander Yakovlevich, and partly for this reason, and partly because in general he liked chess problems, he took the magazine. The girl, tearing herself away from Kellerman, couldn't say how much it cost, but knowing that Fyodor was anyway in debt to the shop, she indifferently let him go. He went away with the pleasant feeling that he would have some fun at home. Being not only an excellent solver of problems, but also being gifted to the highest degree with the ability to compose them, he found therein not only a rest from his literary labors, but certain mysterious lessons. As a writer, he derived something from the very sterility of these exercises. A chess composer does not necessarily have to play well. Fyodor was a very indifferent player and played unwillingly. He was fatigued and infuriated by the disharmony between the lack of stamina of his chess thought in the process of the contest and that exclamation mark rating brilliance for which it strove. For him, the construction of a problem differed from playing in about the same way as a verified sonnet does from the polemics of publicists. The making of such a problem began far from the board, as the making of verse began far from paper, with the body in a horizontal position on the sofa, that is, when the body becomes a distant, dark blue line, its own horizon, when suddenly, from an inner impulse which was indistinguishable from poetic inspiration, he envisioned a bizarre method of embodying this or that refined idea for a problem, say, the combination of two themes, the Indian and the Bristol, or something completely new. For some time, he delighted with closed eyes in the abstract purity of a plan realized only in his mind's eye. Then he hastily opened his Morocco board and the box of weighty pieces, set them out roughly on the run, and it immediately became clear that the idea so purely embodied in his brain would demand here on the board, in order to free it of its thick, carved shell, inconceivable labors, a maximum of mental strain, endless trials and worries, and most of all, that consistent resourcefulness out of which, in the chess sense, truth is constructed. Pondering the alternatives, thus and thus excluding cumbrous constructions, the blots and blanks of support pawns, struggling with duels, he achieved the utmost accuracy of expression, the utmost economy of harmonious forces. If he had not been certain, as he also was in the case of literary creation, that the realization of the scheme already existed in some other world from which he transferred it into this one, then the complex and prolonged work on the board would have been an intolerable burden to the mind, since it would have to concede, together with the possibility of realization, the possibility of its impossibility. Little by little, the pieces and squares began to come to life and exchange impressions. The crude might of the queen was transformed into refined power, restrained and directed by a system of sparkling levers. The pawns grew cleverer. The knights stepped forth with a Spanish caracol. Everything had acquired sense, and at the same time everything was concealed. Every creator is a plotter, and all the pieces impersonating his ideas on the board were here as conspirators and sorcerers. Only in the final instant was their secret spectacularly exposed. One or two more refining touches, one more verification, and the problem was ready. The key to it, White's first move, was masked by its apparent absurdity. But it was precisely by the distance between this and the dazzling denouement that one of the problem's chief merits was measured. And in the way that one piece, as if greased with oil, went smoothly behind another after slipping across the whole field and creeping up under its arm, constituted an almost physical pleasure, the titillating sensation of an ideal fit. Now on the board there shone like a constellation a ravishing work of art, a planetarium of thought. Everything here cheered the chess player's eye. The wit of the threats and defenses, the grace of their interlocked movement, the purity of the mates, so many bullets for exactly so many hearts. Every polished piece seemed to be made especially for its square. But perhaps the most fascinating of all was the fine fabric of deceit, the abundance of insidious tries, the refutation of which had its own accessory beauty, and of false trails carefully prepared for the reader. The third lesson that Friday was with Vasiliev. The editor of the Berlin Emigre Daily had established relations with an obscure English periodical and now contributed a weekly article to it on the situation in Soviet Russia. Having a smattering of the language, he wrote his article out in rough, with gaps and Russian phrases interspersed, and demanded from Fyodor a literal translation of the usual phrases found in leaders. You're only young once, wonders never cease, this is a lion and not a dog, Krylov. Troubles never come singly, Peter's been paid without robbing Paul, jack of all trades, master of none. You can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, necessity is the mother of invention, it's only a lover's tiff. Hark at the pot calling the kettle black. Birds of a feather flock together. The poor man always gets the blame. It's no use crying over spilt milk. We need reform, not reforms. And very often there occurred the expression, it produced the impression of an exploding bomb. Fyodor's task consisted in dictating from Vasiliev's rough copy Vasiliev's article in its corrected form, direct into the typewriter. This seemed extraordinarily practical to Vasiliev, but actually the dictation was monstrously dragged out as a result of the agonizing pauses. But, oddly enough, the method of using old saws and fables turned out to be a condensed way of conveying something of the moralité characteristic of all conscious manifestations of the Soviet authorities. Reading through the finished article, which had seemed rubbish as he dictated it, Fyodor detected under the clumsy translation and the author's journalistic effects the movement of a logical and forceful idea which progressed steadily toward its goal and calmly produced a mate in the corner. Accompanying him afterwards to the door, Vasiliev, with a sudden fierce knitting of his bristly brows, said quickly, "Well, did you see what they've done to Kuncheyev? I can imagine how it affected him. What a blow, what a flop. He couldn't care less." "I know that," replied Fyodor, and an expression of momentary disappointment appeared on Vasiliev's face. "Oh, he's just putting it on," he retorted resourcefully, cheering up again. "In reality, he's sure to be stunned." "I don't think so," said Fyodor. "In any case, I'm sincerely grieved for him," ended Vasiliev, with the look of one who had no wish at all to part with his grief. Somewhat weary, but glad of the fact that his working day was over, Fyodor Konstantinovich boarded a tram and opened his magazine. Again that glimpse of Chernyshevsky's inclined face. All I know about him is that he was a syringe of sulfuric acid, as Razanov, I think, says somewhere, and that he wrote the novel What to Do, which blends in my mind with another social writer's, Whose Fault? He became absorbed in an examination of the problems, and soon satisfied himself that if it had not been for two end games of genius by an old Russian master, plus several interesting reprints from foreign publications, this 8x8 would not have been worth buying. The conscientious student exercises of the young Soviet composers were not so much problems as tasks. Cumbrously they treated of this or that mechanical theme, some kind of pinning and unpinning, without a hint of poetry. These were chess comic strips, nothing more, and the shoving and jostling pieces did their clumsy work with proletarian seriousness, reconciling themselves to the presence of double solutions in the flat variants and to the agglomeration of police pawns. Having missed his stop, he still managed to jump off at the public garden, turning at once on his heels as a man usually does after abruptly leaving a tram, and went by the church along Agamemnonstrasse. It was early evening. The sky was cloudless, and the motionless and quiet sunshine endowed every object with a peaceful, lyrical air of festivity. A bicycle, leaned against a yellow-lit wall, was slightly bent outwards like one of the side horses of a troika. But even more perfect in shape was its transparent shadow on the wall. An elderly, stoutish gentleman, waggling his rear, was hurrying to tennis, wearing a fancy shirt and city trousers, and carrying three gray balls in a net, and beside him, walking swiftly on rubber soles, was a German girl of the sporting sort, with an orange face and golden hair. Behind the brightly painted pumps, a radio was singing in a gas station, while above its pavilion, vertical yellow letters stood against the light blue of the sky, the name of a car firm. And on the second letter, on the E, a pity that it was not on the first, on the B would have made an alphabetic vignette, sat a live blackbird with a yellow, for economy's sake, beak, singing louder than the radio. The house in which Fyodor lived was a corner one, and stuck out like a huge red ship, carrying a complex and glassy turreted structure on its bow, as if a dull, sedate architect had suddenly gone mad and made a sally into the sky. On all the little balconies which girdled the house in tier after tier, there was something green blossoming, and only the Shchogolevs was untidily empty, with an orphaned pot on the parapet, and a corpse hung out in moth-eaten furs to air. Right at the very beginning of his stay in this flat, Fyodor, supposing that he would need complete peace in the evenings, had reserved himself the right to have supper in his room. On the table among his books there now awaited him two gray sandwiches with a glossy mosaic of sausage, a cup of stale tea, and a plate of pink kissel from the morning. Chewing and sipping, he again opened 8x8. He was again glared at by a butting N.G. Che, and began to enjoy quietly a study in which the few white pieces seemed to be hanging over an abyss and yet won the day. Then he found a charming four-mover by an American master, the beauty of which consisted not only of the cleverly hidden mating device, but also of the fact that in reply to a tempting but incorrect attack, Black, by drawing in and blocking his own pieces, managed to construct just in time a hermetic stalemate. Then, in one of the Soviet productions, P. Mitrofanov, Tver, a beautiful example turned up of how to come a cropper. Black had 9 pawns, the 9th having evidently been added at the last minute in order to cure a cook, as if a writer had hastily changed "he will surely be told" in the proofs to the more correct "he will doubtless be told," without noticing that this was immediately followed by "of her doubtful reputation." Suddenly he felt a bitter pang. Why had everything in Russia become so shoddy, so crabbed and gray? How could she have been so befooled and befuddled? Or had the old urge toward the light concealed a fatal flaw, which in the course of progress toward the objective had grown more and more evident until it was revealed that this light was burning in the window of a prison overseer, and that was all. When had this strange dependence sprung up between the sharpening of thirst and the muddying of the source? In the 40s? In the 60s? And what to do now? Ought one not to reject any longing for one's homeland, for any homeland besides that which is with me, within me, which is stuck like the silver sand of the sea to the skin of my souls, lives in my eyes, my blood, gives depth and distance to the background of life's every hope? Some day, interrupting my writing, I will look through the window and see a Russian autumn. Some friends of the Shogolevs, gone to Denmark for the summer, had recently left Boris Ivanovich a radio. One could hear him diddling with it, strangling squeakers and creakers, moving ghostly furniture. An odd pastime. The room, meanwhile, had grown dark. Above the blackened outlines of the houses beyond the yard, where the windows were already alight, the sky had an ultramarine shade, and in the black wires between black chimneys there shone a star, which, like any star, could only properly be seen by switching one's vision so that all the rest moved away out of focus. He propped his cheek on his fist and sat there at the table, looking through the window. In the distance, a large clock, whose position he was always promising himself to define but always forgot, the more so since it was never audible under the layer of daytime sounds, slowly chimed 9 o'clock. It was time to go and meet Zina. They usually met on the other side of the railway bridge, on a quiet street in the vicinity of Grunewald, where the massifs of the houses, dark crossword puzzles in which not everything was yet filled in by yellow light, were interrupted by waste plots, kitchen gardens, and coal houses, the ciphers and sighs of the darkness, a line of Koncheyev's, where there was, by the way, a remarkable fence made out of another one which had been dismantled somewhere else, perhaps in another town, and which had previously surrounded the camp of a wandering circus, but the boards had now been placed in senseless order as if nailed together by a blind man, so that the circus beasts once painted on them and reshuffled during transit had disintegrated into their component parts. Here there was the leg of a zebra, there a tiger's back, and some animal's haunch appeared next to another creature's reversed paw. Life's promise of a life to come had been kept with respect to the fence, but the rupture of the earthly images on it destroyed the earthly value of immortality. At night, however, little could be made out of it. While the exaggerated shadows of the leaves, nearby there was a street light, lay on the boards quite logically in perfect order. This served as a kind of compensation, the more so since it was impossible to transfer them to another place with the boards, having broken up and mixed the pattern. They could only be transferred in toto, together with the whole night. Waiting for her arrival. She was always late, and always came by another road than he. Thus it transpired that even Berlin could be mysterious. Within the linden's bloom the street light winks. A dark and honeyed hush envelops us. Across the curb one's passing shadow slinks. Across a stump a sable ripples thus. The night sky melts to peach beyond that gate. There water gleams. There Venice vaguely shows. Look at that street, it runs to China straight. And yonder star above the Volga glows. Oh, swear to me to put in dreams your trust, and to believe in fantasy alone, and never let your soul in prison rust, nor stretch your arm and say, a wall of stone. She always unexpectedly appeared out of the darkness, like a shadow leaving its kindred element. At first her ankles would catch the light. She moved them close together as if she walked along a slender rope. Her summer dress was short, of night's own color, the color of the street lights and the shadows, of tree trunks and of shining pavement, paler than her bare arms and darker than her face. This kind of blank verse block dedicated to Georgi Chulkov. Fyodor kissed her on her soft lips. She leaned her head for a moment on his collarbone, and then, quickly freeing herself, walked beside him, at first with such sorrow on her face as if during their 20 hours of separation an unheard-of disaster had taken place. But then, little by little, she came to herself, and now smiled as she never did during the day. What was it about her that fascinated him most of all? Her perfect understanding? The absolute pitch of her instinct for everything that he himself loved? In talking to her, one could get along without any bridges, and he would barely have time to notice some amusing feature of the night before she would point it out. And not only was Zina cleverly and elegantly made to measure for him by a very painstaking fate, but both of them, forming a single shadow, were made to the measure of something not quite comprehensible, but wonderful and benevolent, and continuously surrounding them. When he had first moved in with the Shchogolevs, and seen her for the first time, he had had the feeling that he already knew a great deal about her, that even her name had been long familiar to him, and certain characteristics of her life. But until he spoke to her, he was unable to make out whence and how he knew it. At first he saw her only at dinner, and he watched her carefully, studying her every movement. She hardly spoke to him, although by certain signs, not so much by the pupils of her eyes as by their luster that seemed slanted at him, he felt that she was noticing every glance of his, and that all her movements were restricted by the lightest shrouds of that very impression she was producing on him. And because it seemed completely impossible to him that he should have any part in her life, he suffered when he detected something particularly enchanting in her, and was glad and relieved when he glimpsed some flaw in her beauty. Her pale hair, which radiantly and imperceptibly merged into the sunny air around her head, the light blue vein on her temple, another on her long, tender neck, her delicate hand, her sharp elbow, the narrowness of her hips, the weakness of her shoulders, and the peculiar forward slant of her graceful body, as if the floor over which, gathering speed like a skater, she hastened, was always gently sloping away toward the haven of the chair or table on which lay the object she sought. All this was perceived by him with agonizing distinctness, and then during the day was repeated an infinity of times in his memory, returning ever more lazily, pallidly, and jerkily, losing life and dwindling, as a result of the automatic repetitions of the disintegrating image, to a mere sketch, broken and blurred, in which nothing of the original life subsisted. But as soon as he saw her again, all this subconscious work directed at the destruction of her image, whose power he feared more and more, went by the board, and beauty again flared forth. Her nearness, her frightening accessibility to his gaze, the reconstituted union of all the details. If, during those days, he had had to answer before some preter-sensuous court, remember how Goethe said, pointing with his cane at the starry sky, "There is my conscience," he would scarcely have decided to say that he loved her, for he had long since realized that he was incapable of giving his entire soul to anyone or anything. Its working capital was too necessary to him for his own private affairs. But on the other hand, when he looked at her, he immediately reached, in order to fall off again a minute later, such heights of tenderness, passion, and pity as are reached by few loves. And at night, especially after long periods of mental work, half coming out of sleep, not by way of reason, as it were, but through the back door of delirium, with a mad, long-drawn-out rapture, he felt her presence in the room on a camp bed, hastily and carelessly prepared by a property man, 2 paces away from him. But while he nursed his excitement and reveled in the temptation, in the shortness of the distance, in the heavenly possibilities, which incidentally had nothing of the flesh, or rather had some blissful replacement for the flesh, expressed in semi-dreamlike terms, he was enticed back into the oblivion of sleep, whence he hopelessly retreated, thinking he still continued to hold his prize. Actually, she never appeared in his dreams, remaining content to delegate various representatives of hers and her confidants, who bore no resemblance to her, but who produced sensations that made a fool of him, to which the bluish dawn was a witness. And then, waking completely to the sounds of the morning, he immediately landed in the very thick of the happiness sucking at his heart, and it was good to be alive, and there glimmered in the mist some exquisite event which was just about to happen. But on trying to imagine Zina, all he saw was a faint sketch which her voice behind the wall was incapable of igniting with life. And an hour or two later he met her at table, and everything was renewed, and he again understood that without her there would not be any morning mist of happiness. One evening, a fortnight after he had moved in, she knocked on his door, and with a haughtily resolute step and an almost contemptuous expression on her face, entered, holding in her hand a small volume hidden in a pink cover. "I have a request," she said, briskly and curtly. "Will you sign this for me?" Fyodor took the book, and recognized in it a pleasantly worn, pleasantly softened up by 2 years of use, this was something quite new to him, copy of his collection of poems. He began very slowly to unstopper his bottle of ink, although at other times when he wanted to write, the cork would pop out as that in a bottle of champagne. Meanwhile, Zina, watching his fingers fumbling the cork, added hastily, "Only your name, please, only your name." F. Godunov Cherdintsev signed his name, and was about to put the date, but thought better of it, fearing she might detect in this some vulgar emphasis. "That's fine, thank you," she said, and went out, blowing on the page. The next day but one was Sunday, and around 4 it suddenly became clear that she was alone at home. He was reading in his room. She was in the dining room and kept making short expeditions from time to time into her own room across the hall, whistling as she went, and in her light, crisp footfalls there was a topographical enigma, since a door from the dining room led straight into her room. But we are reading, and we will keep on reading. "Longer, longer, and for as long as possible shall I be in a strange country. And although my thoughts, my name, my works will belong to Russia, I myself, my mortal organism, will be removed from it." And at the same time, on his walks in Switzerland, the man who could write thus used to strike dead with his cane the lizards running across his path, the devil's brood, as he said with the squeamishness of a Ukrainian and the hatred of a fanatic. An unimaginable return. The regime, what do I care? Under a monarchy, flags and drums. Under a republic, flags and elections. Again she went by. No, reading was out. Too excited, too full of the feeling that another in his place would have sauntered out and addressed her with casual savoir-faire. But when he imagined himself sailing out, and butting into the dining room, and not knowing what to say, he began to wish that she would soon go out, or that the Shchogolevs would come home. And at the very moment when he decided to stop listening and give his undivided attention to Gogol, Fyodor quickly got up and went into the dining room. She was sitting by the door to the balcony, and with her gleaming lips half-parted, was aiming a thread at a needle. Through the open door, one could see the little sterile balcony and hear the tinny ringing and clicking of leaping raindrops. It was a heavy, warm April shower. "Sorry, I didn't know you were here," said mendacious Fyodor. "I only wanted to say something about that book of mine. It's not the real thing. The poems are bad. I mean, they're not all bad, but generally speaking, those I've been publishing these last 2 years in the Gazeta are much better." "I like very much the one you recited at that evening of poetry," she said, "the one about the swallow that cried out." "Oh, were you there?" Yes, but I've even better ones, I assure you." She suddenly jumped up from her chair, threw her darning on the seat, and with her arms dangling, leaned forward, taking quick, small, gliding steps, she sped into her room and returned with some newspaper clippings, his and Koncheyev's poems. "But I don't think I've everything here," she remarked. "I didn't know that such things happened," said Fyodor. and added awkwardly, "Now I'll ask him to make little holes around them with a perforator, you know, like coupons, so that you can tear them out more easily." She continued to busy herself with a stocking stretched over a wooden mushroom, and without lifting her eyes, but smiling quickly and slyly, she said, "I also know that you used to live at 7 Tannenberg Street. I often went there." "You did?" said Fyodor, amazed. "I used to know Lawrence's wife in St. Petersburg. She gave me drawing lessons." "How queer," said Fyodor. "Romanov is now in Munich," she continued. "A most objectionable character, but I always liked his things." They talked about Romanov and about his pictures. He had reached full maturity. Museums were buying his stuff. Having passed through everything, loaded with rich experience, he had returned to an expressive harmony of line. You know his footballer? There's a reproduction in this magazine. Here it is. The pale, sweaty, tensely distorted face of a player depicted from top to toe, preparing at full speed to shoot with terrible force at the goal. Tousled red hair, a burst of mud on his temple, the taut muscles of his bare neck. A wrinkled, soaking, wet, violet singlet, clinging in spots to his body, comes down low over his spattered shorts and is crossed with the wonderful diagonal of a mighty crease. He is in the act of hooking the ball sideways. One raised hand with wide splayed fingers is a participant in the general tension and surge. But most important, of course, are the legs, a glistening white thigh, an enormous scarred knee, boots swollen with dark mud, thick and shapeless, but nevertheless marked by an extraordinary precise and powerful grace. The stocking has slipped down one vigorously twisted calf. One foot is buried in rich mud, the other is about to kick, and how, the hideous tar-black ball. And all this against a dark gray background saturated with rain and snow. Looking at this picture, one could already hear the whiz of the leather missile, already see the goalkeeper's desperate dive. "And I know something else," said Zina. "You were supposed to help me with a translation. Charsky told you about it, but for some reason you didn't turn up." "How queer," repeated Fyodor. There was a bang in the hall. That was Mariana Nikolaevna returning, and Zina deliberately got up, gathered the cuttings together, and went to her room. Only later did Fyodor understand why she considered it necessary to act that way. But at the moment it seemed to him like discourtesy. And when Mrs. Shchogolev came into the dining room, the result was as if he had been stealing sugar out of the sideboard. One evening, a few days later, he overheard an angry conversation from his room, the gist of which was that guests were due to arrive and that it was time for Zina to go downstairs with the key. He heard her go, and after a brief inner struggle, he thought himself up a walk, say, to the slot machine by the public garden for a postage stamp. To complete the illusion, he put on a hat, although he practically never wore one. The minute light went out while he was on his way down, but immediately there was a click and it went on again. That was she downstairs who had pressed the button. He found her standing by the glass door, playing with the key looped on her finger, the whole of her brightly illuminated. Everything glistened, the turquoise knit of her jumper, her fingernails, and even the little hairs on her forearm. "It's unlocked," she said. But he stopped, and both of them began to look through the glass at the dark, mobile night, at the gas lamp, at the shadow of the railings. "It doesn't look as if they're coming," she muttered, softly clinking the keys. "Have you been waiting long?" he asked. "If you like, I'll take a turn." And at that moment the light went out. "If you like, I'll stay here all night," he added in the darkness. She laughed, and then sighed abruptly, as if fed up with waiting. Through the glass, the ashen light from the street fell on both of them, and the shadow of the iron design on the door undulated over her and continued obliquely over him like a shoulder belt, while a prismatic rainbow lay on the wall. And, as often happened with him, though it was deeper this time than ever before, Fyodor suddenly felt, in this glassy darkness, the strangeness of life, the strangeness of its magic, as if a corner of it had been turned back for an instant, and he had glimpsed its unusual lining. Close to his face, there was her soft, cinereous cheek, cut across by a shadow. And when Zena suddenly, with mysterious bewilderment and a mercurial sparkle in her eyes, turned toward him, and the shadow lay across her lips, oddly changing her, he took advantage of the absolute freedom in this world of shadows to take her by her ghostly elbows. But she slipped out of the pattern, and with a quick jab of her finger restored the light. "Why?" he asked. "I'll explain it some other time," replied Zena, not taking her eyes off him. "Tomorrow," said Pyotr. "All right, tomorrow. Only I want to warn you that there is not going to be any conversation between you and me at home. That's final and for good." "Then let's," he began, but at this point stocky Colonel Kasatkin and his tall, faded wife loomed on the other side of the door. "A very good evening to you, my pretty," said the Colonel, cleaving the night at a single stroke. Fyodor went out into the street. The next day he contrived to catch her on the corner as she returned from work. They arranged to meet after supper by a bench which he had spied out the night before. "Well, why?" he asked, when they had sat down. "For 5 reasons," she said. "In the first place, because I'm not a German girl. In the second place, because only last Wednesday I broke up with my fiancé. In the third place, because it would be, well, pointless. In the fourth place, because you don't know me at all. And in the fifth place..." She fell silent, and Fyodor cautiously kissed her burning, melting, sorrowing lips. "That's why," she said, her fingers running over his and strongly compressing them. Therefore, they met every evening. Mariana Nikolaevna, who never dared to ask her about anything, the very hint of a question would draw forth the familiar storm, guessed that her daughter was meeting someone, the more so since she knew of the mysterious fiancé. He was a strange, sickly, unbalanced person. That at least is how Fyodor imagined him from Zina's description. And of course those described people are usually endowed with one basic characteristic: they never smile. Whom she had met when she was 16, 3 years before, he being 12 years older than she, and in this seniority there was also something dark, unpleasant, and embittered. Then, again, according to her account, their meetings had taken place without any sentiments of love being expressed, and because she never made reference to even a single kiss, the impression was given that this had been simply an endless succession of tedious conversations. She resolutely refused to reveal his name, or even his type of work, although she gave him to understand that he had been in a sense a man of genius. And Fyodor was secretly grateful to her for this, realizing that a ghost with neither name nor environment would fade out more easily. But nevertheless, he experienced pangs of disgusting jealousy which he strove not to probe. But this jealousy was always present, just around the corner, and the thought that somewhere, somewhen, for all he knew, he might meet the anxious, mournful eyes of this gentleman caused everything around him to assume nocturnal habits of life, like nature during an eclipse. Zena swore that she had never loved him, that from lack of willpower she had been dragging out a tired romance with him, and would have continued to do so had it not been for Fyodor coming along. But he was unable to discern any particular lack of willpower in her. Rather, he noticed a mixture of feminine shyness and unfeminine resoluteness in everything. Despite the complexity of her mind, a most convincing simplicity was natural to her, so that she could permit herself much that others would be unable to get away with, and the very speed of their coming together seemed to Fyodor completely natural in the sharp light of her directness. At home, she behaved in such a way that it was monstrous to imagine an evening rendezvous with this alien, sullen young lady. But it was not pretense. Rather, it was also an idiosyncratic form of directness. When he once jokingly stopped her in the little corridor, she paled with anger and did not come to meet him that evening. And later, she forced him to swear on oath that he would never do that again. Very soon he understood why this was so. The domestic situation was of such a low-grade variety that, with it as a background, the fugitive touching of hands between a boarder and the landlord's daughter would have been turned simply into goings-on. Zina's father, Oskar Grigorievich Merz, had died of angina pectoris in Berlin 4 years ago, and immediately after his death, Mariana Nikolaevna had married a man whom Merz would not have allowed over his threshold, one of those cocky and corny Russians who, when the occasion presents itself, savor the word yid as if it were a fat fig. But whenever good Shchogolev was away, there quite simply appeared in the house one of his fishy business friends, a skinny Baltic baron with whom Mariana Nikolaevna deceived him. And Fyodor, who had happened to see the baron once or twice, could not help wondering with a shudder of disgust what they could find in one another. And, if they found anything, what procedure did they adopt, this elderly, fleshy woman with a toad's face, and this old skeleton with decaying teeth? If it was sometimes agonizing to know that Zina was alone in the flat and that their agreement prevented him talking to her, it was agonizing in a totally different way when Shchogolev remained alone at home. No lover of solitude, Boris Ivanovich would soon begin to get bored, and from his room Fyodor would hear the rustling growth of this boredom as if the flat were slowly being overgrown with burdocks, which had now grown up to his door. He would pray to fate that something might distract Shchogolev, but until he got the radio, salvation was not forthcoming. Inevitably came the ominous, tactful knock, and Boris Ivanovich, horribly smiling, squeezed sideways into the room. "Were you asleep? Did I disturb you?" he would ask, seeing Fyodor flat on his back on the sofa, and then, ingressing entirely, he would shut the door tightly behind him and sit by Fyodor's feet, sighing. "It's deadly dull," he would say, and would launch upon some pet subject. In the realm of literature, he had a high opinion of L'Homme qui assassina by Claude Farrère, and in the realm of philosophy, he had studied the Protocols of the Sages of Zion. He could discuss these two books for hours, and it seemed that he had read nothing else in his life. He was generous with stories of judicial practice in the provinces and with Jewish anecdotes. Instead of, "We had some champagne and set out," he expressed himself as follows: "We cracked a bottle of fizz and hup!" As with most babblers, his reminiscences always contained some extraordinary conversationalist who told him endless things of interest. "I've never met anyone as clever as he in all my life," he would remark somewhat uncivilly. And since it was impossible to imagine Boris Ivanovich in the role of a silent listener, one had to allow that this was a special form of split personality. Once, when he had noticed some written-up sheets of paper on Fyodor's desk, he said, adopting a new heartfelt tone of voice, "Ah, if only I had a tick or two, what a novel I'd whip off. From real life. Imagine this kind of thing. An old dog, but still in his prime, fiery, thirsting for happiness, gets to know a widow. And she has a daughter. Still quite a little girl. You know what I mean? When nothing is formed yet, but already she has a way of walking that drives you out of your mind. A slip of a girl, very fair, pale, with blue under the eyes. And of course she doesn't even look at the old goat. What to do? Well, not long thinking, he ups and marries the widow. Okay. They settle down, the three of them. Here you can go on indefinitely. The temptation, the eternal torment, the itch, the mad hopes. And the upshot? A miscalculation. Time flies. She gets older. She blossoms out. And not a sausage. Just walks by and scorches you with a look of contempt, eh? You feel here a kind of Dostoevskian tragedy? That story, you see, happened to a great friend of mine once upon a time in Fairyland, when old King Cole was a merry old soul." And Boris Ivanovich, turning his dark eyes away, pursed his lips and emitted a melancholy, bursting sound. My better half, he said on another occasion, was for 20 years the wife of a kike and got mixed up with a whole rabble of Jew in-laws. I had to expend quite a bit of effort to get rid of that stink. Zena, he alternately called his stepdaughter either this or Aida, depending on his mood, thank God doesn't have anything specific. You should see her cousin, one of these fat little brunettes, you know, with a fuzzy upper lip. In fact, it has occurred to me that my Mariana, when she was Madame Mertz, might have had other interests. One can't help being drawn to one's own people, you know. Let her tell you herself how she suffocated in that atmosphere. What relatives she acquired. Oh, my gut! All gabbling at table and she pouring out the tea. And to think that her mother was a lady-in-waiting of the Empress, and that she herself had gone to the Smolny School for Young Ladies. And then she went and married a Yid. To this very day she can't explain how it happened. He was rich, she says, and she was stupid. They met in Nice. She eloped to Rome with him. In the open air, you know, it all looked different. Well, but when afterwards the little clan closed upon her, she saw she was stuck. Zena told it quite differently. In her version, the image of her father took on something of Proust's swan. His marriage to her mother and their subsequent life were tinted with a romantic haze. Judging by her words, and judging also by the photographs of him, he had been a refined, noble, intelligent, and kindly man, even in these stiff St. Petersburg cabinet pictures with a gold-stamped signature on the thick cardboard, which she showed Fyodor at night under a street lamp. The old-fashioned luxuriance of his blonde moustache and the height of his collars did nothing to spoil his delicate features and direct, laughing gaze. She told him about his scented handkerchief and his passion for trotting races and music, and that time in his youth when he had routed a visiting grandmaster of chess, and the way he recited Homer by heart. In talking of him, she selected things that might touch Fyodor's imagination, since it seemed to her that she detected something sluggish and bored in his reaction to her reminiscences of her father, that is, to the most precious thing she had to show him. He himself noticed this strangely delayed responsiveness of his. Zena had one quality which embarrassed him. Her home life had developed in her a morbidly acute pride, so that even when talking to Fyodor, she referred to her race with challenging emphasis, as if stressing the fact that she took for granted, a fact which its stressing denied, that he regarded Jews not only without the hostility present to a greater or lesser degree in the majority of Russians, but did so without the chilly smile of forced goodwill. In the beginning, she drew these strings so taut that he, who in general did not give a damn about the classification of people according to race or racial interrelations, began to feel a bit awkward for her. And on the other hand, under the influence of her burning, watchful pride, he became aware of a kind of personal shame for listening silently to Shchogolev's loathsome rot and to his trick of garbling Russian in imitation of a farcical Jewish accent. As when he said, for instance, to a wet guest who had left traces on the carpet, "Oi, vat a mudnik!" For a certain time after her father's death, their former friends and relatives from his side had automatically continued to visit her mother and her. But little by little they thinned out and fell away, and only one old couple for a long time continued to come, feeling sorry for Mariana Nikolaevna, feeling sorry for the past, and trying to ignore Shchogolev's retreating to his bedroom with a cup of tea and a newspaper. But Zena had continued to preserve her connection with the world her mother had betrayed, and on visits to these former family friends she changed extraordinarily, grew softer and kinder. She herself remarked upon this, as she sat at the tea table among the quiet conversations of old people about illnesses, weddings, and Russian literature. At home she was unhappy, and this unhappiness she despised. She also despised her work, even though her boss was a Jew, however, a German Jew, that is, first of all, a German, so that she had no qualms about abusing him in Fyodor's presence. So vividly, so bitterly, and with such revulsion did she tell him about that lawyer's office where she had already been working for 2 years, that he saw and smelled everything as if he himself were there every day. The atmosphere of her office reminded him somehow of Dickens, in a German paraphrase, it is true, a semi-insane world of gloomy, lean men and repulsive, chubby ones, subterfuge, black shadows, nightmare snouts, dust, stench, and women's tears. It began with a dark, steep, incredibly dilapidated staircase, which was fully matched by the sinister decrepitude of the office premises, a state of affairs not true only of the chief barrister's office, with its overstuffed armchairs and giant glass-topped table furnishings. The main office, large, plain, with bare, shuddering windows, was choked with an accumulation of dirty, dusty furniture. Especially dreadful was the sofa, of a dull purple color with protruding springs, a horrible, obscene object dumped here after gradually passing through the offices of all three directors, Traum, Baum, and Käsebier. The innumerable shelves blocking every inch of wall were crammed with grim blue folders that stuck out their long labels, along which from time to time crawled a hungry, litigious bedbug. By the windows worked four typists. One was a hunchback who spent her salary on clothes. The second was a slender, flighty little thing whose father, a butcher, had been killed with a meat hook by his hot-tempered son. The third was a defenseless young girl who was slowly collecting a trousseau. And the fourth was a married woman, a buxom blonde, whose soul was little more than a replica of her apartment, and who recounted movingly how, after a day of spiritual labor, she felt such a thirst for the relaxation of physical work that upon coming home she would throw open all the windows and joyously set about the washing. The office manager, Hameke, a fat, coarse animal with smelly feet and a perpetually oozing furuncle on the nape, who liked to recall how in his sergeant days he had made clumsy recruits clean the barrack room floor with toothbrushes, used to persecute the latter two with particular pleasure. One, because the loss of her job for her would have meant not getting married, the other because she forthwith began to cry, those abundant, noisy tears which were so easy to provoke afforded him wholesome pleasure. Hardly literate, but gifted with an iron grip, immediately able to grasp the most unsavory aspect of any case, he was highly prized by his employers, Traum, Baum, and Käsebier, a complete German idol, with little tables amid the greenery and a wonderful view. Baum was rarely to be seen. The office maidens found that he dressed marvelously, and in truth his suit was as rigid as on a marble statue, with everlastingly creased pants and a white collar attached to a colored shirt. Käsebier cringed before his prosperous clients. For that matter, all three of them cringed. But when he grew angry with Zena, he accused her of putting on airs. The boss, Traum, was a shortish man with hair distributed in such a way as to conceal his bald spot, with a profile like the outside of a half moon, tiny hands, and a shapeless body more wide than it was fat. He loved himself with a passionate and completely reciprocated love, was married to a rich elderly widow, and having something of the actor in his nature, strove to do everything in style, spending thousands for show, and haggling with his secretary over a nickel. He demanded of his employees that they refer to his wife as die gnädige Frau. The missus telephoned, the missus left a message, and plumed himself on a sublime ignorance of what went on at the office, although in fact he knew everything through Hameke, right down to the last blot. In his capacity as one of the legal consultants to the French embassy, he often traveled to Paris. And since his outstanding characteristic was a tremendously smooth effrontery in the pursuit of advantages, he energetically struck up useful acquaintances while there, shamelessly asking for recommendations, badgering, foisting himself upon people without feeling the snubs. His skin was like the armor on a peba. In order to gain popularity in France, he wrote little books in German on French themes. Three portraits, for example, the Empress Eugénie, Briand, and Sarah Bernhardt. And in the course of their preparation, the collecting of materials turned into the collecting of connections. These hastily compiled works, in the terrible stil moderne of the German Republic, and essentially yielding little to the works of Ludwig and Zweig's, were dictated by him to his secretary between business, when he suddenly feigned a flow of inspiration, which flow, incidentally, always coincided with a stretch of leisure time. Some French professor, into whose friendship he had insinuated himself, once answered a most tender epistle of his with, for a Frenchman, extremely blunt criticism. "You write the name Deschanel at times with an accent aigu, and at others without it. Since a certain uniformity is necessary here, it would be good if you were to take a firm decision as to which system you wish to adhere to, and then stick to it. If for any reason you should desire to write this name correctly, then write it without an accent." Traum at once responded with a rapturously grateful letter, continuing at the same time to ask for favors. Oh, how well he could round out and sweeten his letters! What Teutonic warblings and whistlings there were in the endless modulation of his openings and conclusions! What courtesies! Vous avez bien voulu bien vouloir. His secretary, Dora Wittgenstein, who had worked for him for 14 years, shared a small, musty office with Zena. This aging woman, with bags under her eyes, smelling of carrion through her cheap eau de cologne, who worked for any number of hours, and who had dried up in the service of Traum, resembled an unfortunate, worn-out horse whose whole muscular system had been displaced, leaving only a few iron tendons. She was little educated, organized her life according to 2 or 3 generally accepted concepts, and in her dealings with French was guided by certain private rules of her own. When Traum was writing his periodic book, he would call her to his house on Sundays, haggle over her payment, and keep her for extra time.